Welcome to Trapping Across America, where fur brothers meet every week. Where we're still allowed to be men, and we're proud to be from the land of the fur and the home of the brave. This is your host, Clint Locklear. I apologize for the show coming out one day late than normal. I'm going to try to keep on schedule as best I can. To be honest with everybody, I didn't plan ahead enough this week. We have some windows being put in our house, and every time I thought it was going to be quiet enough for me to try to record the show, there was beating and prying and cussing and screaming going on, and it just wouldn't have sounded very good in the background. So I got up real early. This is Saturday morning. It's about 5 o'clock. They're coming again this morning, but I'm gonna try to beat them to the punch so I can get this out. And what I kind of want to talk about, and what the reason that I think this is an important topic, besides it's probably going to be entertaining to some people, it's also going to be very educational to some people. I was talking 3 or 4 times this last week to Randy. He was kind of quizzing me about some places I've been. He's thinking about going after some otter and wanting to know the difference, you know, of the states, the laws, and different things like that. And then I've had a lot of people just over the year, you know, that are thinking about going to Texas or New Mexico or Missouri, or they're wanting to state hop or go to a different part of their state. And, you know, not to sound like a blowhard or anything, but because of my lifestyle as choosing to be a trapper the way that I have, I've got quite a bit of experience of what it's like in different parts of the country, because I've trapped in, hell, I don't know, I probably should have wrote it down to make it sound more impressive, I guess, and run through the numbers and I really know what I'm talking about here, but it's like 17, 20, 21 states, something like that, that I've been trapping in. And a lot of that's due to control work. And when I first started trapping and going full time, a lot of that was based off of me being a fur trapper and where I live, except for, you know, a few animals. There's not a whole lot you can really hammer to try to make a living at it. So I would go, and I'd go to different places. And so what I want to kind of do, and I don't think we're going to get all of them done in this show, but what I want to talk about are some of the places that I've been trapping, some of the stories about that, the laws, animal populations, what you need to kind of look out for in those places. So it's more of a realistic view if you're going to state hop or go somewhere. Because if you've never state hopped, guys, it's something every trapper needs to experience at least 3 times. And the reason I say 3 times is most of the time, your first time, you're going to fall kind of flat. You're not going to understand what you really need. There's a lot of, you know, dreaming going on, but maybe not as much planning as possible. Or you overplan and you're not very mobile when you need to be if things aren't working out the way that it should be. And then the next time it gets a little better. Normally on that third trip when you go somewhere, it seems like everything, unless it's just a total nightmare happens, that everything seems to fall in place. And it's right where it should be. You can make some money. You see a lot of territory. You catch a lot of animals. You know what's going on. You understand the laws. And you understand what you should be packing. Now, I'm not going to go into the just ins and outs of state hopping today. But I do want to talk about some of the different things in the different states that I've learned that could save you some time, some money. And if it's a certain type of situation you want to get into, knock yourself out, man. There's a lot of fur out there in the country. It's just begging for you to go get it if you're willing to get off the couch and go get it, or leave your home base and go get it. And if it's something you're planning on, or you're getting closer to retirement, because trappers do seem to be getting a little older, you know, start looking around at different places you can go. Because there's one thing about going on an out-of-state trip, especially the first 3 or 4 times you go somewhere, it is like a 6-year-old kid looking forward to Christmas, because you're thinking about everything you need to have and what's going to be there and what's it going to be like. And when you go to sleep at night, instead of Santa Claus filling your stocking full of candy and stuff like that, you're seeing piles of animals and clear blue skies and the whole nine yards. And it's an awesome thing for an adult to have something once a year, twice a year, that he can look ahead for, be excited about, and plan for, and go out and do what he wants to do. Where you get out of the grind of the everyday, being a responsible adult, it seems like you get up, you go to work, you get to play a little bit in the evenings and on the weekends, you go to sleep, and you repeat the process over and over and over again. When you get to go out of state, you get to be the trapper, because you're not having the honeydew list and all the little problems that seems to build up for you at work, and all the strife at work and the monotony of work, and it's brand new and you're really energized, and you'll probably trap harder than you have in years. And it's just exciting. There's no other way to put it. It's just exciting to be able to do that. So I want to go over some of the states I've been, some of the lessons that I've learned on it, some of the stories about them. And this may take several shows because I've been to a lot of places. But from a lot of the questions and emails and things like that where people are asking all the time about this, this could be a good source of information, because the website is going to be here. You can go back to this 3-4 years from now in the archives and go, you know, I'm thinking about maybe going to Louisiana to beaver trap or do bounty or otter trap, or I want to go down there because of the rules and be able to snare, and I can't snare in my state. What was some of the things Clint said about Louisiana? Well, you can go back to the archives on Trapping Radio site, and you can listen to it again. And one of the things I'd really appreciate at the bottom of this show is, if you've been somewhere and there's some things that you've noticed about it, like, you know, maybe some of the laws that people need to be aware of, or some of the populated areas that, you know, maybe people should stay away from, just some of your own stories about what it was like to go to different places. If you want to put those down in the comments, it'll be fascinating for me included and everybody else to hear what your experiences were in there. And I just think that would be a really neat thing to do. But let's go ahead and get started in this. And I'm going to start on the state of Alaska, because that's where I started trapping. And I'm not going to go into everything like I did when I was kind of making fun of myself getting started in trapping. But there's some things about Alaska that are pretty fascinating. One, it is the ultimate outdoor state in the country. Hands down, bar none, no question about it. When I was up there, If you want to go move up there and you want to deal with the cold and the snow and all that, which is not as bad as it sounds, at least when I was younger it wasn't, you have, it's just absolutely amazing up there, because you have something that you can go chase, hunt, fish, or trap, all except for about 2 weeks out of the year. You will be totally exhausted if you're an outdoorsman up there. Because you go from spring bear hunting, and then you're going to go into all the different fish. It seems to come along in stages just to make sure you never get any sleep. And in the summertime, because there's so much daylight up there, you just keep going and going and going. I mean, salmon fishing at 1, 2 in the morning is pretty normal. And then you follow this range all the way out to your moose and your caribou season. Then you get into your trapping season, and the appreciation you have for such a wild place after being in that situation really lets you wonder what America was like a couple hundred years ago. Or if the Great North was really that much different than what America was like. I really don't know, because I didn't live back then. I can read some of the stuff, but Alaska is a really cool state. Like I said, you could go into a grocery store and buy some trapping supplies. When you went into a video store, 3/4 of it was hunting and fishing and trapping, and you had this little bitty section of the movies that were out. So it's really part of their culture. There's a lot of fur and stuff up there, fur buyers up there. The state association, which I wish I'd have known what that was really when I was up there, so I could have joined into that. But they do have something up there that can be frustrating and confusing to someone that wants to go up there and trap. Most places in the country, if you got permission on someone's property, you just go trap. And if it's legal to road trap, or you have national forest or state forest that they let you trap on, or WMAs and different state game lands that you can go trap on. Well, you just load up and you just go have a good time. In Alaska, you have dedicated trap lines. Now, what's interesting about these dedicated trap lines, they're not legal dedicated trap lines, but the trappers, and I tell you this, this is a God honest truth. It may not be legal, but it might as well be, because the trappers up there are very closed-minded about someone coming across their trap line, because they spend a lot of time up there. They have to cut the brush for the snow machines. They build these lines up and they're leaning poles and their boxes over years and years, and they build cabins and have caches. They have traps out there. A lot of them cover a long distance. And the closer you are to a town like Anchorage, Willow, Fairbanks, stuff like that, they seem to be more concentrated, because just because you're living in Alaska doesn't mean you don't have to make a living too. And you have family obligations and all that. So the closer you get to towns, the more concentrated these trap lines are. And a lot of the trap lines, just because of the ease of using the rivers as a road system when it freezes up there, those get pretty congested. And I saw a lot of guys when I were up there, and that's where they would always start their trap line, was on the Chena River and different places like that, going all the way up towards the Yukon River, about 8 hours out of Fairbanks. And they would go in different directions, and you would see four or five of them going up there, and they'd go in different directions kind of for security. But the snowmobile is the way to go when you get to Alaska. So if you're going to ever think about going to Alaska, you need to be somewhat mechanically minded, if your snow machine doesn't work when it gets cold, to know how to fix it. Because if you're 30, 40 miles out in the bush up there, and your snow machine breaks, it's a long walk back through 4 or 5 feet of snow. So you need to know how to use that, and you have to understand the expense of that. And I read a neat article about Alaska while I was up there that kind of gave me some hope about what I was doing. I snowshoed because I couldn't afford a snow machine. And I didn't coming from Tennessee, I wasn't really that keen on the idea of being on a snow machine. I didn't understand exactly how they work. I knew I would get in trouble, because unless you're around them a lot, there's a lot of things dealing with, you know, when the water's opening up and deep snow and hills and weight and all that. I really didn't want to go through that learning curve, but I couldn't afford it anyway, so I did the snowshoe thing. Well, this article that I read was very interesting, and it was about a guy who went up to Alaska back in the 70s, I believe, and he started with snowshoes. And kind of keep this in mind when you're going up there. If you're wanting a lot of fur in Alaska, snowshoes are probably not the way to go, because you're limited to how far you can walk. Now, because of the winter, you could probably have about 5 or 6 or 7 different lines going in different directions, but you're still going to have to walk that with your snow machines. And this guy that wrote this article, he went up there, he wanted to be a professional trapper. His first couple of years, he about starved to death, about froze to death, kind of started figuring things out, but he's on his snowshoes, and he caught a certain amount of fox, and lynx, wolverine, marten, mink, some beaver. Well, then, you know, he brought it all back in, had it all put up and sold it, and he had a net profit of a certain amount of money. Well, after a couple of years, he got tired of walking around on snowshoes, so he decided he was going to jump on the snow machine bandwagon. And he bought a guy's trap line. It was already laid out, had the cabins. And he went up, and he really went to work on everything. But all of a sudden, the logistics of his trap line changed, where he was having to put food in different cabins and repair the cabins and spending weeks and weeks getting all his supplies out to his caches and his satellite cabins that he had. And then he has 55-gallon drums of gas he was bringing in for a snow machine, and an extra snow machine in case that one broke, and all the spare parts and this. Well, he went out and he trapped, and he actually caught a tremendous more amount of fur. When he went and sold it, and he looked at the numbers, lo and behold, he made about the same money as he did when he was using snowshoes because of the expenses. And then he kept getting aggravated with the snow machines because they're always breaking. You know, they're not the machines that we have today. Back in the 70s, I'm sure they were shorter, didn't have the power and all the conveniences of a new machine would have. So he decided he'd go to sled dogs. Well, he really went and got some good dogs and learned how to use them and learned how to feed them. And he could cover not quite as much distance, but quite a bit, but didn't have to bring in the fuel, the spare parts and all that. Well, what happened to him up in Alaska, because when you go somewhere like that, or up, way up in Canada, I'm sure it's the same, your expenses rack up really high. And now he's fishing for all summer long to have enough food for his dogs, and they changed the laws, and they didn't want you catching all these fish to feed your dogs. They wanted you to buy commercial dog food and the sleds and everything else. Well, lo and behold, he caught a little bit less fur than he did on the snow machine, a whole lot more fur than he did on his snow shoes. But when he ran the numbers, he was making about the same amount of dollar in profit as he was when he was snowshoes. Towards, you know, I think it was about the late 80s, he went back to the snowshoes, ran smaller lines, had less cost, got to be more in tune with what was around him on his trap lines, and was making the same amount of money because he had the logistics in place from knowing how to do the snow machines and the all the experience with setting that many more traps. And he actually, towards the end, said he made a little bit more money off of the snowshoes than he did that. So why am I telling you all that? When you go somewhere that's new and it's strange, a lot of time the best thing you can do is go very simple, because you can get really wrapped up, like I'm going to talk about in Iowa and places like that and on down the road if we get there today. If you try to follow what the locals are doing all the time, you're not having the same experience they are. You're not set up the same logistically as they are. And sometimes it can actually be a detriment to try to follow what they're doing when you go certain places, just because it's not your native trap line. And that's kind of what this guy learned when he was in Alaska. But Alaska is one of those places that's very unforgiving. When you're out by yourself like that, if you're the kind of guy that needs a lot of social interaction, you're probably going to get pretty lonely, unless you're coming back home every night and everything's expensive up there, including your fuel. So you're going to add a lot of expenses to it if you're not staying out there so many nights a week. And that's just the way it is. So going to Alaska to trap, it really does take a different breed of person to be able to handle their self on their own with not a lot of the supports of the modern society that we have. Saying that, that is some of the most beautiful fur I've ever seen in my life. When I was calling fox and trapping fox up in Alaska, and you come up on a red fox and the hair on its neck is literally sticking out farther than his ears when he's looking at you, you know you've got something special. And that's the way most of them were. The fox were a lot bigger than our fox here down in the lower 48. The marten were probably twice as big as you'll catch in the lower 48. It's part of the reason they're worth more money. They have a lot more hair on them. We didn't have coyotes at that time where I was at in Alaska, so I don't know what those looked like. But all the fur is so much better. So you don't have to catch as much in Alaska to actually make pretty good money most years. Because when I came back from the Alaska, a red fox up there was bringing $50 green. When I got back here, you're doing good to sell a red fox for $15. That was the difference from that. So if you're going up there and you start talking to people, a lot of guys in the lower 48 go, well, he only caught, 67 animals. Well, what was he doing? Well, he was making money is what he was doing. Because, for one, when you go to Alaska, you go to more wilderness-type areas, in our mind, we think of Jeremiah Johnson, and there's not people hunting, and you don't have competition and stuff like that. But Alaska is one of those states that you do come across certain situations where you have a lot of animals in one place. Like Minnow Flats outside of Fairbanks, Alaska, had a lot of fox. Why did it have a lot of fox? Because the dump the city dump was not that far from there, and they were scavenging in that dump. So there was a lot of population right there, red fox. But you get out in the true brush, in a 5 to 10 mile loop on snowshoes, you may come across two sets of fox tracks, a whole lot of rabbit tracks, some marten tracks, and if you're lucky, lynx or a wolverine track. And that's 10 miles of going out through there. Now here in the lower 48, in the south and the northeast and southwest and stuff like that, you see tracks everywhere. The animal density up there is really low per square mile. That's why a lot of the guys up there use the snow machines and they use the dogs, because if they want to break 100, 150 marten, 200 marten, stuff like that, their trap lines up there on those snow machines are 200 and 300 and 400 miles that they're checking in a week going on these different loops. So if you're going up there, just keep in mind, they don't have the animal density populations that we do here. And if you're going to go up there for a vacation and stay with a relative or someone that's in the military or something like that and go trap line, I'm going to give you a quick story of why you have to try to get a hold of the state association up there, the Alaskan Trapper Association. Find out who's working in that area. And if you're going to be somewhere close to one of those trap lines, look them up and just go talk to them. Just tell them, look, you know, I'm going to run so many traps. I'm going to be up right off the road. Is there any place around here, because it's going to be where your trap line's at, that you're not going to get upset if I kind of go off the road a couple of miles and come back to the road? Because one of the first things that happened to me when I was starting my trapping up there is I would just drive, like I said, and if there was a place to stop, then my God, that's where I started trapping. Well, one of the places I go, it was in between Fairbanks and Nanana, and I go off the side of this ridge. I'm crossing all these little ridge points, setting my marten traps. Well, I come back, and about four of my traps are gone. The wire's cut, trap's gone. 110's not that expensive, but the idea of someone stealing my trap just boiled my blood. I was very new in the trapping, and I didn't realize that's just part of life that much. But on every one of my little nail things that I was using for my cubbies, there was a business card. And on the back, it didn't say anything, but the business card was a local tannery there in Fairbanks. And by the time I get to the all the traps that I assume this guy was stealing, I am fuming when I get back to my little S10 Blazer. I turn that thing around and I go straight back to Fairbanks and I look up his address and I go through the door. And let me tell you, I was going to kill him. I was going to, well, probably not kill him, but I was going to make him think he was about to die. And when I went in there, he was a little older than I was, super nice guy. And I went in there, and I slammed the card down on his countertop right there, and I wanted to hear what he was going to say first, because I thought he was going to start squirming and all that, because he was a trap thief. And he said, "So you're the one that was running across my trap line." And I'm like, "What do you mean your trap line?" And he went through what it was to have a designated trap line. He bought that trap line from another trapper several years ago, and he's trying to manage it, and they didn't want, you know, you don't allow people to come on and start trapping on it because the population numbers are not that high, and you want to be able to farm your trap line to make it sustainable. And the more he explained this, and he never got rude or mad, he could tell I was mad, I'm pretty sure, because I was probably about four shades of red. I understood what he was doing, and then he reached down and he pulls out a box and he sets it on the counter, and inside there is my 110 and 120 conibears. And he's, you know, and then I got to know the guy, and he was super, super nice. No, what they're doing up there is not technically legal. A game warden is not going to come up to you and give you a ticket for trapping across someone's trap line. But as respect to other trappers, as odd as this may seem in the lower 48, because the animal densities are lower, it's best to respect that. Because if you get in a mess out there, way out in the brush somewhere, and you need help, about the only person that's going to help you during that time of the year is going to be another trapper. They rely on each other, they respect each other, and they help each other. but they want everybody to respect their trap line. So if you're going up there, try to kind of keep that in mind. The first road trip I took when I first got back trapping and I decided I wanted to do the long line, I was reading all the old Gorman books, and I think a lot of it had to do, my wife, she saved up some money, and we got some package from one of these people that sell vacations. And anyway, she wanted to go to Negril, Jamaica. And the plane tickets were cheap at the time, and the little place we were staying at was you know, not the best quality, but it was cheap. So we went there, and we had a little week vacation in Jamaica. Well, the only book I had with me on the way out there was Craig O'Gorman's High Rolling Coon Trapping. Because in the brochures, the little place we're staying at, they had a full stock library. I don't know what I'm going to do in Jamaica while Cindy's sitting on the beach all day, so I figured I'd read. So I get over there, and I go to the library, and it's all in Chinese. Well, I can't read Chinese, so the only book I've got for a week to sit on the beach with, besides looking at all the European women that have a lot less on their bathing suits, if they have them at all, was Craig O'Gorman's High Rolling Coon book. So I read that book pretty much every day for a week straight, and it was getting closer to the fall. And I just read it and read it and read it because I didn't have anything else to read, and you can only look at the water so much from my point of view. So I'm thinking about this, and we've got some relatives at that time lived over in Milan, Tennessee. This is West Tennessee. If you don't know where that's at, you can look on a map. And it's pretty much north of Jackson, probably about 20, 30 miles. It's a small town. Jackson's a bigger town. And we went out there a few times to visit them on the holidays. And everywhere I looked, I was going across creeks. And as a trapper, you're going to notice such things. And when I first started getting into trapping, I was more of a water trapper. So I went out, and I went scouting a few days. And I mean, there were coon tracks, and there were beaver dams, and there were otter toilets, and cat tracks under the bridges out there. And I mean, I about had the shakes by the time I got back home. And I could care less about the turkey at Thanksgiving, because all I could think about was the fur walking around out there. So the next year, I work out a deal with them to come out there for a couple of weeks, and I'm going to raccoon trap. So I get every trap I've got. And here's going to be some lessons coming to you about everything you got may not always be the best thing. Well, I go to West Tennessee, and I get one of the gazetteer books where it has all the little roads and the maps and stuff like that. And I'm looking for the most straight line loops that I can do that cover the most water. Kind of makes sense to anybody that's going to be a water trapper. Well, lo and behold, what had more water on it than anything else was Interstate 40 going between Jackson and Memphis, Tennessee. So that's the first line of my loop that I start running out. And technically, it's not illegal to trap off the interstate. I can tell you, I-40, with all the traffic going through there, going from east and west, from the east coast to the west coast, that is a busy interstate. I didn't care. I was young, dumb. I was raring to go. So I load up all these traps. I get in my, what was I driving at that time? I think it was like an 86 three-quarter ton white Chevrolet. Great big honking thing, and it wasn't even a four-wheel drive. But I didn't care. I was going to stay on the roads. So I load up the first day, and I get down to the interstate, and every time I saw a culvert or a ditch, I slam on the brakes, pull over as far as I can, and I'm just setting traps left and right, going off the O'Gorman model. Two traps for every stop, get as many stops as you can set. You know, I can hear Don Bolt giving him his little lectures in there from the book as I'm setting. I'm grinning, I'm seeing trap sign, I'm getting all excited. Now, what did I have for traps at that time? I had a lot of stock number two Victors with no pan tension. I had a lot of 1.5 long springs because some of the older books that I was reading at that time had that. I had a bunch of very weak 1.5s. Now, keep in mind, I hadn't been trapping that long. O'Gorman's talking about, set your trap back 6-8 inches, have it 6-8 inches deep, you know, just stick your finger or T-bar in the side of the pocket, smear it on the bank, run a stick through a fish head. I was doing all that. I mean, I felt like I was a little mini old Norman out there running around, and I was flying high. But what I learned on that trip, one, they don't mark national refuges from the interstate. Now, I'm not saying I was on any of them. I'm taking the fifth on that. But the more times I went out there, I realized, hey, I don't need to stop at these bridges. Never got in trouble, but I didn't realize that going out. So if you're going out of state and you're going to trap somewhere new, make sure you know where you're at all times, and where you can and where you can't set. Because from the interstate, that creek looks just like every other creek. And if there's not signs there, you possibly don't know. My losses on that trip were absolutely staggering with equipment that I had. Now, I was probably running 200 miles every day, and I was catching about 18 coon. Now, someone that's out in the Midwest, they're going to laugh at those numbers. But here in the East, that's a pretty good day coon trapping. What was sickening to me, because I had weak equipment that wasn't modified, I was probably having about a 30 to 40% pull out or chew out ratio. But I was still having a really good time. At that time, the lure I was using was O'Gorman's White Ring. And I still keep a couple of jars of that around. And when I'm going out of state, or I'm, you know, missing going state hopping or something like that, I'll open that bottle, I'll stick my nose in there, and I'll just suck it up. And I can remember, it's like I can smell West Tennessee in those trap lines when I do that. Back when I had a lot rougher trucks, I used to actually take White Ring in there in the summer, and I'd smear it on the dash so the sun would heat it up. And let me tell you, I was just like a cat on catnip with that stuff in the truck. I mean, I loved it. But it brought back the memories of the first long lining that I've ever done. And I learned a lot of things on that trip. One, interstates are not the safest places to set a trap, because you have guardrails when you get in flatter country and you've got a lot of water like you have in West Tennessee. So a lot of times I'm parking right up next to where the passenger side window is literally overhanging the guardrail. And then I've got to look in my rearview mirror in time getting in and out of the truck with 18-wheelers. And when they were, and it's not like they would get over either. So I'm having those big honking trucks going about 6 inches from my driver's side mirror. And when you would pull over, I mean, your car would just shudder when they would go past you, your truck would. And then you would, but being young, nothing's ever going to happen to you. I'd wait till there's an opening. I would jump out, grab my stuff, run over, and I would do my trapping. One of the things towards the end of the trip that I found fascinating, I'm a pretty stubborn guy by nature. I'll tell you that. If I think I'm doing the right thing, you know, I don't back down from laws and stuff like that, that I know that if I'm in the right on them, I don't cower down fairly easy. And when we get into Mississippi, you'll see how this really can play in a disadvantage to you. But I'd come out of these creeks, and I'd only be down there a few minutes, and I'd pull up, and there'd be these orange stickers on the back of my truck from the state trooper saying, you know, the vehicle's found dead on the side of the road between mile marker this and this, and they'd stick it on the back window of my truck, and I'm like thinking, well, good grief, I was just right over the bank. And if you look in the back of the truck, you know, there's blood, mud, coons, traps, everything like that, the motor's still warm. They never even paid attention. It never registered to the state troopers that I was trapping. I couldn't find any law that says I couldn't do it, so all I'd do is scrape the, peel the sticker off, throw it down the bed of the truck, and I'd go to the next one. Well, there were some days I was having five or six of these stickers on the back of my truck by the time I got from Jackson, Mississippi to Memphis. I never really had one waiting on me when I came out. You know, kind of when I'm thinking back on it, they must have thought that I was a very determined, broke-down truck, because every day it was in a different position, and an hour later it'd be 50 miles down the road and broke down again. I really don't know what they were thinking, because they had to have been calling those in. And probably over the 2 weeks I was down there, I probably had 40 or 50 of those stickers wadded up in the back of my truck. but nothing really ever came of it. But West Tennessee was one of the first places that I went longlining that actually had a decent amount of animals. Now, where I live here, right at the base of the Cumberland Plateau, where at, you know, kind of where the Appalachian Mountains are kind of running out on the southern end and on the western end of that, except for some of the bottom land, we just don't have a big animal population here. You could trap all winter here, and I'm talking from November to the end of February, and if you catch 200 coons, I mean, you're kicking butt. Well, I could go out to West Tennessee, and I'm taking 18 a day was my average. Some days in mid-20s, some days around 10 or 11. But when I averaged it out, it was 18. And besides that, doing, I don't know, 10, 12, 15 beaver a day. But if you want to go somewhere that you can get permission, you got to keep in mind, West Tennessee, as good as that is, we've changed the laws here in Tennessee. We've got a peckerhead up in our law enforcement division of the TWRA, excuse me, that decided trapping was going to be the same as hunting, and he started mixing hunting laws and trapping laws and made it very clear that he was going to do that and prosecute. So when he did that, he kind of took the road trapping away in Tennessee. We used to get road trap, bridge trap. So they took that away. The beautiful part about West Tennessee, if you're looking for somewhere to go, and this is where Hal Sullivan goes and Charlie Dobbins used to go, and I know there's a lot of guys from Wisconsin and Pennsylvania that used to come down. The trapping license now in Tennessee is $400 or $500 for out of state. And the reason they did that, not this time where the otter price is going up, but the last time where it got really otter crazy in the country, there were so many people coming to West Tennessee to trap, the state decided they wanted to make more money off of them. So we went from like $120 for an out-of-state license to $400 and something or $501. I'm not sure which one it is, but it's really, really expensive. Well, then the otter market crashed and they didn't make any money because it wasn't worth anybody's time to come down and even beaver trap as much beavers here. But if you're looking for a place to go later in the year, because our trapping seasons here in Tennessee go almost till March. You know, they'll go from the 15th to the 23rd, something like that, of February, depending on the year, it seems like. So you've got a fairly long season. And if you're somewhere like Illinois or Michigan, or and you're looking for an area to go to that has a tremendous amount of animals, and I'm talking lots of gray fox, lots of cats, there's lots of otter in West Tennessee. There are barge fulls of beaver. And there's a decent coon population. A lot of the otter that you'll get can be really super pale, which is not exactly what they're looking for this year, but they're still selling very good. The coon aren't that big. Your average size coon out there is probably going to be probably 30 inches when he's stretched. You'll get some twos and threes, but you'll be right around that 30 inch mark for most of them. They're just not that big. The beaver hides are actually pretty good in some places. In some places they're really crappy. And when you get to some of the big swamps and stuff like that where they don't have the agriculture and they're just living off of buck brush and pine trees and cedar trees and privet and stuff like that, and they don't have the agriculture to back them up, the hides will decrease in value because of that. So you need to keep that in mind if you're coming out here. The cats can run a gamut from, like on this year, from $30 probably to $150 to $200. So you'll catch some crappy cats and you'll catch some beautiful spotted cats out there. They're not going to be normally as big as in certain places like we have here in the mountains, but their quality does seem to be a little bit better. You're getting closer to the Midwest style of animals, populations, and numbers of animals when you go out to West Tennessee. There's a lot of water in West Tennessee. There's a lot of farmers that are really needing help all the time in West Tennessee for beaver control. So if you're looking for somewhere to go and you're in a state that's going to get snowed out a lot, I would seriously look at West Tennessee, because right now, you know, five otter and you got your out-of-state license paid for. But you're going to have somewhere to stay and you're going to either have to go off of a boat or a canoe, which I'm going to talk about, or private permissions. West Tennessee, being like the Midwest, they seem to have a lot more rough weather than we do over here in the East as far as mud. They have a lot of plowed fields. You're not going to be driving your truck around in the fields, or you're going to have to get a bulldozer to come get you out. But if you come down there with a four-wheeler and you spend some time talking with some farmers, you could probably build a very good trap line out in West Tennessee if you wanted to, and have a good amount of animals to go out there and get. And the parts of the West Tennessee that I trapped, if you want to look on a map, and I had several lines in here, was between Milan, Jackson, Memphis, and Union City, Tennessee. And I would run through there. Now, there's a feature in West Tennessee, if you ever want to go out there, and it is the Hatchie Bottoms, and that thing runs all the way down through the state. And there's parts of the south where you get closer to Mississippi where the Hatchie Bottoms has got a lot of roads crossing it. I never went down there. I stayed a little farther north. But there's a lot of boat ramps on there. And in Tennessee, because TVA owns most of the waterways here, you can go to the high water mark. In a lot of places, you can go to an elevation mark. What that means to you is you can get out on the banks a lot of times in Tennessee and trap and still be legal. The downside of boat trapping in Tennessee is we get a lot of rain and it can flood really fast and really bad. I was on a trip out there one time and a friend of mine came down from Pennsylvania. And besides my brother saying, he just moved out there and was in an apartment, and he said, well, I've got a guy that's got a hunting cabin y'all can stay in. I can ask him, and we worked that out. We show up, and I mean, we come armed to the teeth with traps. And his hunting cabin was actually a slave shack that hasn't been touched since before the Civil War. It was still standing, and the only thing it was there for was for his dad to be able to shoot deer off his tree stand that was on the back porch, which was 3 bales of hay and a 5-gallon bucket. But he gave us the key to the door, and there was a new lock on the door, and we go in, and if you were into constellations, you could study them all night because there wasn't that much of a roof on the place. And it was down in the 15-20 degree mark all day and all night when we were out there. But this is one of the things about going to West Tennessee you need to understand. It can get warm, it can get hot, it can stay both ways, but it's going to rain. And there is a chance you're going to have to deal with a lot of flooding. We set out 2 different lines. It started raining. We didn't see those traps for 4 days. We pulled those traps out of all that slop and mess, redo the lines. It started raining that evening. We didn't see those traps again for 6 days. Now, we're staying and freezing to death in a rat field, no ceiling, slave shack in the middle of nowhere with no heat source except a Coleman lantern and a Coleman cook stove. And let me tell you, that was some miserable, miserable times trying to stay warm in that thing. When it was raining, we had to actually nail a tarp to one wall, run it through the rafters, and let it go on an angle so the water and the snow would come down and run off to go through the holes that were in the floor we were at. So if you're going somewhere, kind of do some research on what the hunting cabin is going to be. But what happened to us on that trip is we never got a full 24 hours on a trap line. After the third time it flooded back to back, friend had to get back to Pennsylvania, and I had to go find somewhere to make some money because that's all I was doing for income was trapping. So once we could get our traps back after the third time, we both hauled butt out of there. And when you go on out-of-state trips, not to discourage anybody, that's just part of the game. That is part of the game. You're going to have washouts. A lot of guys that write the books and do the videos like me, they're not going to tell you that. But that's just the way it is. Everybody gets their butt kicked every now and then. And when you get in certain places with the weather, and you're going to get your butt kicked that way. But West Tennessee is a very neat place with a lot of animals. You do have to be aware of the weather, but it gives you a long season, and the beaver are just coming in their own about the time the season's going out. So you get some pretty good quality stuff. And a lot of times, if you do your homework ahead of time, you can get some farmers to help pay for your fuel, put you up, maybe some some running money while you're down there. And with the otter prices the way they are, if you're going to work out of a boat, you can go in West Tennessee. I could normally go out there and take 50 to 60 otter in a couple of weeks' time, a couple hundred beaver and a couple hundred raccoons, 3 or 4 dozen cats, 3 or 4 dozen gray fox. And with decent prices on the fur, I could do pretty good in a couple of weeks. But I was running about 200 miles a day to do that. Gas was only 85 cents at the time. So you got to keep that in context. Since we're getting short on time, the last one I'm going to talk about today is going to be Michigan. I met a fella up at the FTA trapping school, a trapping college, excuse me, that lived up in Grand Rapids, Michigan, and never met him before, and we got to talking, and he was saying he had all his property lined up and stuff, and, you know, I'm thinking about the Great North, and the coons are bigger, and everything like that, and, you know, you hear a lot of the northern guys catching all these coon, and I was into the water trapping, so I load up my stuff, and at that time, it was a six-cylinder red Ford truck, two-wheel drive, F-250, loaded up 16-foot trailer. I mean, everything I could think I could need. And I was all set up for water. And I head to Grand Rapids, Michigan. Now, there is a lot of water in Grand Rapids, Michigan. But it just happened to fall. Everywhere he had permission, there was hardly any water to be. So that was the first time in my life I had to learn how to be a dryland coon trapper. In between us, because we can't set conibears on the ground here in Tennessee, I had maybe a dozen. He had a dozen. He hadn't been trapping that long, and his trapping stuff, he was pretty much buying odds and ends off eBay. So, you know, we're out there coon trapping with what I had and everything from number four jumps to those 550 eliminator things from the fur boom. This was before really any of the dog proof traps. This was, I don't know, 6, 7, 8, maybe 10, 12 years ago. Not very good on time, but this is before the dog proof traps were really on the market. And I think the only time at that time that was out there was an egg trap. My friend had a couple of those, and then he had a couple of duffers. And my first experience with dog proof traps were pretty much horrendous, so I didn't put a lot of faith in those. Dog proof traps. Well, they were complicated to work and stuff like that. So we're going, and so we have to get creative on the raccoons. And this is the first time in my life that I've ever dragged a raccoon. I had some drags with me, and that was pretty much the start of me seeing the value of a good drag. I was using the J.C. Connor ones at the time. It's about the only thing that was on the market besides Craig's, and I couldn't afford Craig's. So I had a couple of dozen of them with me, because I was envisioning just being able to throw them down in the water in a pocket set, those big old coon, because I was up to modified traps by this point, and I knew it wasn't going to hurt them. But we got out, and lo and behold, we're in farm country, and Michigan is a beautiful, beautiful state. If you could just get all the liberals and politicians and socialists out of there, and the union representatives up there, and let that part of the world be what it should be in a farming country and a manufacturing company. Michigan is a beautiful state, and they've got some beautiful animals. And the farmers that I met were very receptive to someone catching raccoons, you know, and a few of them wanted us to catch some fox and cows, but it was mostly raccoons. But I was in awe how beautiful that part of Michigan was. And so we went out, and we're setting dirt holes, which was slow. We had a few conibears, and that's when I really saw how good conibears were on coon, because I hadn't got to do it up to that point. But the thing that we found worked best on the dry land coon is we cut up a bunch of PVC, 10, 12 inches long, put it on an angle. We'd drive that down in the ground right next to the coon trail, put some leaves in there, throw some bait, and set a trap in front of it, and just set the drag to the side. It was fairly quick. It worked very well, and that's kind of our operation. We were up there, we were doing some odds and end traps and stuff, and neither one of us was really into trapping for a lot of years at that time, so we tried a lot of goofy stuff too. hey, I heard this in Fur Fishing Game, and I know everybody out here is listening, has done the same thing. And this guy said, if you do this, this, and this, I mean, you'll just wear them out. So we'd go into a section and we'd try that. And most of the time, more complicated it got, just like anything else in life, the worse the results were. But the thing about Michigan that absolutely floored me is he worked at a steel case manufacturing plant there in Grand Rapids, and he had some farmers that did have some creeks. My rat trapping at that time was pretty much, I'd see some droppings on a log and I'd set that up, or I'd see a den and I'd put a conibear in front of it. And that was pretty much my whole rat trapping experience. When I got to Michigan, back then, by God, Michigan had the rats. And they were in these little bitty creeks that wouldn't really hold anything here because they would dry up in the summer here. And you would see the dens. And then we actually went to a golf course there somewhere around Grand Rapids, and we set those up. We only had like 8 or 10 colony traps that he ordered offline, and we had some 110s and some 220s. And we went to start setting those up. Now, here's something else you need to keep in mind if you're going out of state. Things are different in different places. Where I live, muskrats don't make huts. They don't make feed beds. I've never seen that before. I've seen it on videos. I've seen it in trapping books. Never been around them before. Now, when you're 6'2", 300 pounds, and you step off into some of those marshes, you learn real quick there's not really a bottom to them, especially up in Michigan. And I'm trying to catch muskrats the way I would catch them here in Michigan. And he was catching them the way he was taught in Michigan. Because I could do what I could do here and he could do what he could do there, I was pretty resistant about following how the locals did something. His way outproduced mine until we got to the golf course, and then it was pretty much den trapping, which is pretty much the simplest way to catch a muskrat. But when we were in those ponds with the feed huts and the cattails, and I mean, when you pulled up, you're just envisioning your next check would have 20 or 30 rats in there because you'd see all these houses out there. From a southern guy going up to a northern area with a totally different thing I was looking at, I'm here to tell you, I got my ass kicked on those houses because every now and then I could find where they were going in, but by the time I did, I completely destroyed all the silt and the grass and the way they were coming out. And I don't think I ever caught a muskrat going in or out of their house. I didn't understand the principle that he was using catching them on the side of the house, but I could, because I've done so much beaver trapping in those cattails. I'm like, well, a muskrat looks like a little beaver, and you can see where they're swimming through the cattails here. So I started doing dive poles and setting the 110s, if it was too deep, to set them where they're half in, half out of the water, where the muskrat would go under the dive pole just like a beaver and get caught. So that was kind of my stick when I was up there in Michigan. But if I would have known ahead of time when I was going to Michigan that there would have been so little water on most of the places that we had. I mean, he had places strung out over 3 or 4 counties. And some of them were pretty good-sized ponds. Most of them didn't have a pond or a creek. I was a water trapper from Tennessee where I would go, at that time, set a lot of pockets and wobble sets and stuff like that. I was kind of lost for a while learning how to do the dry land stuff. So if you're going to be going to a different place with the technologies we have now with Google Maps, and you can buy the really good gazetteer maps, if you're a water trapper and a place has a lot of coons, and you're going to run out there thinking you're always going to be able to do what you can do on your home turf, you're going to have to be really open to what you find when you get out there, and you're going to have to adapt really quick most of the time, because that's just the fact of going somewhere new. And I like that personally. I think that scares a lot of people because you may get in a situation where you can't do it the way you've done it for the last 10 years. But it's one thing about state hopping, when you go to these different states, it forces you to become a better trapper. It forces you to interact and deal with a different culture of people, because I can tell you, Southern Appalachian male in rural Southern Michigan is two different cultures. Totally different cultures. You know, for one, they think we're stupid because we talk slow. Well, you know, I kind of like that because that leaves them at a disadvantage in a conversation because they're thinking they're talking to a two-year-old. So that didn't really bother me. But the way that you get along with each other and you talk and you cut up, it's totally different. And you have to learn that. And I think you grow as a person because of that. Because a lot of those people in Michigan's never really been out of Michigan. They just thought everything should be like Michigan. Well, if you came out of the mountains of Tennessee here, you would assume everything should be like it is in the mountains of Tennessee, and it's not. The trapping's not, the culture's not, the ground is not, your staking systems aren't. You can be more dry, you can be more wet, the coons can act different, the food sources can be different. You know, trapping early season like that and having it snow off and on, luckily didn't get deep and it didn't hurt us that bad. It was really cool to me, it was really aggravating to him because he's going to live in snow pretty much after I left anyway. But Michigan is a really cool state as far as the point of if you've got the water and you've got the rats. You know, we were catching mink and coon sets and rat sets and stuff like that. You don't really do that here. And you don't do that in a lot of places I've been. And the mink were a lot more populated up there and a lot more, even that early in the season, they were running a lot harder than I've ever seen before. And the beaver, oh my God, the beaver. Here's another thing you'll learn. I'm going to close with this. Here's the difference between what I've learned, and don't take it offense to this at anything. The reason most northern beaver trappers are so castor-minded and castor-male-minded when they trap, those beaver up there would almost chase you down the road if you had a good beaver lure in the back of your truck. I've never seen anything like it. The beaver at that time were just coming into season the last few days that I was there because they've got some weird seasons up there. It's not just open like it is here. So we put out a few sets, and I mean, it was like, bam! I mean, every one of them had something in it, and I'm like, wow! Well, then, seeing how they responded to a castor lure, I started playing around, and eventually, I was about 50 feet off the water up towards a bridge embankment, smearing the castor on the bridge embankment and having beaver going up to that and getting caught. That don't happen here. You know, I've heard some stories about guys coming out of Minnesota and go down to Mississippi and Louisiana and think they're going to whoop the world with castor mound sets and refuse to adapt to what they're getting into and how the beaver are reacting, and come away with just a handful of beaver. But up north, they can catch 60 in a night. That's the difference when you start traveling around. If the beaver wouldn't have reacted to castor that way, I would trap more like I did here. And if you're coming from the north and coming south and think beaver are going to be that aggressive towards castor, and you're not willing to change, you're going to get your butt kicked on a trap line down here. You've got to go to a lot more blind sets and choking down and travel ways and stuff like that because they don't respond to the lure in the same, I'm talking about aggressive manner they would up there. That was one of the biggest, you know, learning how to dry land coon trap, trying to figure out how to trap those muskrat huts. I got a little bit better at it, but I still don't think I'd want to go somewhere and rely on trapping on muskrat huts because I don't know that much about them. And then the difference between Michigan and Tennessee with how aggressive beaver lure and how the beavers reacted to that. So I've got to learn a lot about that. And if you're going from one place to the other, you need to keep these things in mind about what your ground's going to be like. And you learn from a southern trapper, you get in these peat bog fields. Well, when it's dry, you can drive a truck on them. When it's wet, you can sink up to your nipples in them. So it's not the best place to be setting a coyote trap. I'm not going to get into how I know that, but that got plumb ugly trying to get a coyote. Luckily, didn't pull the stake out of that slop when it got wet. But we couldn't even clean the coyote off no matter how much we washed him coming out of one of those things. So that's another thing that I learned when I was up there. And if you start traveling around, your experience level starts getting a whole lot more. And the value of state hopping like that is all of a sudden now, you can take what you learned in different places and the way those animals react, and you can start fusing that with what you're doing. And lo and behold, after a few trips going to a few different areas, you're really racking up some fur because you've got all that experience that's outside of the little circle that you're used to being in that you can bring into that circle and really become a better trapper. Like I said, I'm going to go ahead and stop this today, and I'm going to talk about New Mexico, Louisiana, Mississippi, and Iowa probably next week. And then I'm going to keep going down all the way through Texas and Missouri and all the other different places in North Carolina and some of the stuff I've got into with them and some of the different things I've learned. And if you're thinking about going to those states, pay attention to those shows because there's some information there. I'm sure it's going to help you out. I'm going to be, for anybody that's around PA and you've got the time, I'm going to be at the Pennsylvania Outdoor Show. I think it's like the 4th of February for the next 9 days after that through the next Sunday. And if you're around that area and you're coming to the show, I'll be outside of the archery area of the show in the hallway. You'll see all my big pictures and flat screens and all that. But if you're going to be up there, man, please stop by because the more trappers that I get to meet at those shows, the more sane I stay because most of the people I meet there are not trappers. Last time I was there, I got cussed out because I was killing all the cheetahs in Texas. I had some black people want to start a fight because I've got a lure called Coon Crack. So the more sane people, which to me are trappers, that I get to hang around with when I'm up there, the better off I'm going to be. So if you're in that area, please stop by and say hi and hang out for a little bit. But till next time, have a good week this week. Enjoy your trapping. Hopefully, you know, in the south here, it actually acts like winter for a little bit. But have a good time trapping. Hope your fur shed's getting full. I hope you get a lot of money for the work that you've done this winter. And I'll see you next week on Trapping Across America.